Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about French actress Catherine Deneuve. And I know that her parents were actors, and that's pretty much all I know about her, you know, the early years until she meets Roger Vadim. But Mike, what do you want to say about her start?
Well, it's significant to mention, Marie, as you did, that she's from a family of actors. It was the family business, if you will. And to that, on an ultimately melancholic note, to observe that her sister, Françoise d'Orléac, was also an actress, and actually as well known as Catherine Deneuve would have been back in the early 1960s. But Françoise d'Orléac, the sister, died in a car crash at the age of 26 in 1967. And that was just such a horrible thing that Deneuve never talked about it. You know, you can't blame her. I mean, who wants to go, you know, revisit that? Only in more recent years as she's talked about it a bit more openly. But she and her sister were both getting into acting at about the same point. Because that was happening, you know, you have parents who are actors and you have these siblings who are actors. There's the potential for confusion, I would think, in terms of, well, who am I watching on screen? And that may well explain why Françoise d'Orléac kept the family name. D'Orléac was the family name. Catherine Deneuve assumed her mother's maiden name as her professional name. So I think it was a very smart move. You know what I mean? They were able to distinguish themselves there by name. And then, you know, ultimately now, it's sad to say this, in addition to the sister dying so young, the sister, in a sense, and it sounds crass to say this out loud, but the sister almost becomes like a footnote to Deneuve's career that way. And it's sort of a cruel way to put it, but you know, frankly, that's sort of what happens, is you have to remind yourself that if her sister hadn't died so young, so tragically, how fascinating to think about this, the what ifs, right? You know, Catherine Deneuve becomes a major movie star. Well, her sister was on the same path. They could have been two major movie stars. Imagine the movies they could have made together. Or if they had a famous feud, they could be like, you know, Joan Fontaine and Olivia de Havilland or something. They could have a famous feud between siblings or something. But anyway, in France, she was blessed in the sense that the family itself was certainly going to be supportive. And really, she really was able to make a name for herself pretty quickly. You know, she didn't have like incredible obstacles or stumbling or whatever. I mean, she really got into the business, if you will. It is a business. She got into it.
Well, she managed to get some success fairly early on. And I'm thinking of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, unless you have something earlier you wanted to start off with, Mike. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is, you know, and it sounds now today like it wouldn't be such a hard sell. It's all sung. And the reason I say it wouldn't be such a hard sell now is because everybody loves Hamilton, which is the same sort of everything, all the dialogue is sung. There's really no stopping for soliloquies or anything like that. And this is a really young Catherine Deneuve doing the singing, and she really is not bad. She's also absolutely breathtaking. When we have Jacques Demy, who wrote and directed this and uses this kind of candy colored palette that just makes it so incredibly charming and just pulls you into the story so much because it's so incredibly visual. Everything from Catherine Deneuve's blonde hair to every little detail about each of the umbrellas and the shop. And then it has this underlying musical with it. And yet it's not like a Hollywood musical where everything turns out great in the end. It has a very specific story it tells. And it, you know, when you read the story itself, you think that doesn't sound like it would be as compelling as the movie actually is.
Well, I think of it as like a French version of an MGM musical. And if you actually watch it, you can see elements there that are really lifted from the whole genre of the Hollywood musical, right? But it's very much a French take on that. Marie, when you also mentioned how young Catherine Deneuve was, she was, but to underscore that even more, she made her first movie in 1956. And even though she had success, by success here, I mean, she was a working actor, okay? She was not a movie star in the late 50s or early 60s, but she was working. And I have a lot of respect for that, you know, she just kept going as an actor, movies that haven't held up or aren't even ever talked about, but she was working, she was employed. The movie that really made her an international success was The Umbrellas of Cherbourg in 1964. That is the breakthrough film. For my money, I oftentimes think of it as her debut. I know it wasn't. I can, you know, give you film credits from earlier, going back to the mid 50s, but you know what? Who cares about those films? You know what I mean? This is like backstory. Her story really begins with Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And I loved your description of it. It really is very much a pop cultural relic from the 1960s. It has that candy colored, slightly garish look to it, which you can tie it into earlier like MGM type musicals, Technicolor look, right? You know, like, wow, those colors are popping, right? It has that quality, which you can trace all the way back through Hollywood musicals, but it also is very much of its moment. It's very much a mid 60s kind of silly. You could say it's superficial and I say, yeah, but what a surface, you know, what a glorious surface that it has. And a large part of that has to do with her physical presence. I mean, obviously she's one of the most, you know, beautiful women in the world. In fact, I'm not the only one to say that. In the 1960s, Look magazine described her as, quote, the most beautiful woman in the world, close quote. I might want to offer Sophia Loren as an alternate choice, but I'm happy with Catherine Deneuve. But when you think about the sheer physicality, the beauty of her, and again, in a color film where the colors pop, like Umbrellas of Cherbourg, was hair ever blonder? You know what I'm getting at? It's like just really pale skin and the blonde hair and just, you know, it's an iconic image there. And it's a really good, a really enjoyable film. But even if it weren't, I mean, just take a still photo, you know, an image from that film. And my goodness, how striking it is, how French it is in a lot of ways. So I like to say that's really the movie that launches her career in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think it's one of her greatest roles by way of roles that shape a career. By way of acting, I would say one of her greatest roles comes the next year with Roman Polanski's Repulsion from 1965. Marie, why don't I know you love that film as much as I do, so let me hand off to you on this one.
Well, I did want to mention that the Umbrella Shop still exists if you want to go check it out. It even has a plaque commemorating the film, and that there was kind of a follow-up film, Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, of 1967, which was not successful, even though it had Gene Kelly in it, because I don't know, you just couldn't capture that lightning in a bottle twice. Or maybe it's too forced in that Gene Kelly just didn't seem like he fit into that movie. All very bizarre.
Yeah, Young Girls of Rochefort is not very successful as a film. And one reason why it doesn't work, and you've identified reasons why it doesn't quite work, Gene Kelly just doesn't quite fit. But also there's the sense of, you know, when you've had a hit film, like Umbrellas of Cherbourg really played the art house circuit around the world and did really well. When you try to follow up in a way that seems almost craven, and by craven, I mean just simply like taking the magic that's in a bottle there and trying to like, you know, deliver another dose of it. I'm going to mix metaphors before long, but you know what I'm getting at? Like the first film was so good, trying to recapture that, it almost does seem exploitative, doesn't it? As if you had a really good film and now you're trying to do it again. Almost as if like, oh my God, they have my money already. They want me to fork over more money to see a mild variation on the same formula. It has that quality to it, you're right. So, the Young Girls of Rochefort comes out 3 years later. And the only reason it's mentioned now is because it's the follow-up, if you will, to Umbrellas of Cherbourg and much the lesser of the two. But it's an indication, you know, besides slamming it as a film, an indication of because Umbrellas was so influential, not surprising they would have a more or less sequel to it, right? And I think that's sort of what you're getting at too, that you could see why they'd want to follow up that way. But let's get back to Repulsion, because I know you love that film, and I do too. I think it's one of her greatest films.
Actually, I'd like to talk about it in terms of, you know, comparing it with Belle du Jour, because to me they seem very similar in that they have this female character is played by Catherine Deneuve, who acts in a way you don't expect, and where you're not sure if what's happening is really happening or in her mind, and involves just all kinds of really disturbing imagery in terms of what they do to women in these movies. So what do you want to say about that, Mike?
I want to say a lot about that. Push come to shove, what are my favorite Catherine Deneuve roles? Repulsion is one, 1965. You know, she's doing that for Roman Polanski. He had just made Knife in the Water. He's really on the ascendant. You know, very gifted director, whatever one might say about his later personal life, very gifted director, certainly at this period. When she makes that 1965, 2 years later, she makes Belle du Jour for Luis Buñuel, the great Spanish director. He's working in France now. And really, the whole remaining period of his career is in France. Those are two of her very greatest roles. And Marie, you've identified some of the reasons why. She plays these characters, not just that these are repressed women, but the fact that they are really bottled up in such a way that you're not quite sure what's going on inside. You know what I'm getting at? I mean, there's the beautiful face, but it's a troubled face. You're not quite sure what her thoughts are. And then in terms of how these characters will act or act out, if you will, there's some really disturbing stuff that happens in those films. And, you know, when you describe You know, if you go from being a bourgeois housewife, you know, in Belle du Jour to a prostitute, well, you know, there's some explaining to do. But the women themselves, Marie, this is your point again, the female protagonist herself does not say much, does not explain in a kind of Hollywood way, where here's why I went bad, or here's why I did this or that. And for me, it's the essence of Catherine Deneuve. There's that she became known for a cool reserve. In other words, for a kind of placid quality where when someone would say she was statuesque, almost as if she were a statue, as if she were this emblematic, you know, iconic French figure, beautiful face, but what are her thoughts? And directors like Roman Polanski in Repulsion and Louis Buñuel in Belle du Jour play off of that. The fact that she's in some ways incredibly beautiful, but also incredibly unapproachable, unknowable. There's a mysterious enigmatic quality. And I want to give you a quote from Catherine Deneuve herself, because she certainly was aware of that quality, and she knew that directors were casting her for that reason. And here's how she responded to that when it was brought up in an interview. "People talk about my reserve, but it is not something I thought up. It's something not cold, but cool, that makes people want to know more. There is an attraction when you do not know everything." It's a great quote, and it's the essence of her character there. When you're looking at a close-up of her face in Repulsion or in Belle du Jour, and then you start thinking about some of the extreme plot twists there, how can you not wonder what's going on inside? What makes her tick? Well, the character, as scripted, is not going to give you a tell-all speech. There's no big psychoanalytic speech that comes from the character. And Buñuel, of course, was one to never explain. You know, the whole thing with his surrealism, these things happen. Like in Belle du Jour, there's the mysterious box. It's a gift item. And what's in the box? People would always ask him. And, you know, it's a running joke in the film. It's like this box and there's something in it, who knows what. And of course, naturally, people would always ask Buñuel, what's in the box? You know, well for one thing, the characters in the film are never going to say, right? They're not going to explain or show you. And moreover, Buñuel wouldn't say either. And he said, why? In one interview, he said, why ask me? I don't know what's there either. Which is the perfect Buñuelian answer. But it's a way in which he could joke about things like that. But on a more serious level, when you look at a character like the one, like Belle du Jour, when you look at the character she plays, there are things that happen in life that can't be readily explained.
You know, you did mention the, you know, classic beauty that she had. I did want to mention that from 1985 to 1989, her image was used to represent Marianne, the national symbol of France. She does have that kind of cool beauty. So I'm not surprised that that would be the case. I did want to mention, Mike, that in 1969, she also did Mississippi Mermaid with Truffaut. So, you know, you have to be impressed that she's worked with all the greats. I mean, Buñuel and Polanski and Truffaut. And yet in this period of time, I kind of think of them as, you know, the lost character women, where everybody's mysterious.
Yeah, one thing to add to that, I mean, just, you know, as she'd worked with, you know, Truffaut and Buñuel and you know, Roman Polanski, these great directors, a mark of how highly they thought of her was the fact that after making Belle du Jour for Buñuel in 1967, she makes another film with Buñuel, Tristana, in 1970. Buñuel occasionally would work with movie stars, with name actors. Other films of his, not at all, but a sign of how much he respected her that he asked her to make another film. But Marie, very much to your point, this is a period in the late 60s, getting into the 70s, where she's working with the major directors. And I'm so glad you mentioned Mississippi Mermaid. I mean, you know, Truffaut, the most famous of the French New Wave directors, you know, working with him. I mean, they want to work with her. And then, of course, we'll talk, and I should turn this over to you at this point, The Last Metro in 1980. The fact that, you know, she's working and working with some of them like Buñuel and Truffaut on multiple occasions, a measure of the respect they had for her as an actor. And yes, I'm so glad you mentioned the fact that she was officially the face of France, you know, that she gets to play Marianne. And there was a lot written about that, actually, as to how they selected her and how everyone agreed that she represents France. So at this point, let me turn this back over to you for one of her most French of all films, if you will, Last Metro.
Okay, well, to get there, I just want to mention a couple of other things about what we've just discussed. In terms of Belle du Jour, in the rape scene, her dress was fitted with Velcro to give a tearing sound as it was ripped away. So just so you know that little detail when you're watching it, but, you know, in order to give it that really intense sound, everything is just so over the top in some ways with that movie. And then in terms of, I know what I wanted to ask you, Mike, before we got to The Last Metro, was talking about how she worked with all the great directors. I think she would have made such an excellent Hitchcock blonde, because she has that first of all, just the classic beauty and the, you know, still waters run deep where you think there must be more than what meets the eye, but you can't stop looking at her. I think she's got a Grace Kelly-esque kind of beauty, and I would have loved to have seen her in a Hitchcock film.
Yeah, I've often had that same thought. It's one of the great missed opportunities, because that would have been a point really like 1960s into 1970s, where if the right project had come along, I've never heard it mentioned in any like straightforward way that, you know, she was considered or yada, yada, nothing of the sort. This is entirely fantasy on my part. This is entirely hypothetical. What if? It's what if film history? What if she had worked with Hitchcock? But very much to your point, you think about Grace Kelly, you think about that cool Hitchcock blonde, and my goodness, she, you know, Eva Marie Saint, you think about Kim Novak, you know, Tippi Hedren, you think about those Hitchcock blondes, and she would have been a perfect addition to that lineup. And a lot of it is simply because Hitchcock liked to frame his actors in such a way that they were pieces he moved around on the game board, right? And there are a lot of shots where it's simply the image of that actor. It's the profile, you know, it's that face that holds the camera. And Hitchcock oftentimes didn't want to have somebody giving a tell-all bit of expositional dialogue, right? It's just like, here's the presence, the physical presence. And you're right, Maria, it would have been terrific to have her. But oh well, it's too late now to make that movie, but wouldn't have been great to have it.
Now, the movie that makes me think that, so if you're looking at Catherine Deneuve movies, the most Hitchcock-like is that Mississippi Mermaid. It does have, you know, a little bit of a quality. It's a thriller, so it does have a little bit. You could sort of see Hitchcock doing it instead of Buñuel, and we wouldn't have to change a whole lot of things. But getting to The Last Metro, that's certainly one of the movies that I think people associate with Catherine Deneuve as one of her best films. Would you agree, Mike?
It's one of Truffaut's best known films, and by extension, one of her best known films. Marie, why don't you tell us a bit more about the film to explain some of the reasons why within the French film industry at this point, it really is considered a high watermark for a French film in that period. Because I mean, I could say more about it now, but I'd rather turn it over to you because I know you like that film a lot.
I do like that film a lot, but you set it up so perfectly that I'm going to give it back to you because you clearly have the answer prepared.
Well, it's just simply that, you know, for actors of that generation, whether it's Catherine Deneuve or Gérard Depardieu, I mean, you know, it's got that acting talent. It's got Truffaut really at the height of his powers still. You know, it's got the kind of storyline that just is so French and just so perfectly realized. So yeah, I think for everyone involved there, the director and the actors and so on, it's sort of a high watermark and an indication of how well received it was and did well in the United States, actually, critically and commercially. She gets, you know, English language roles bouncing off of that. Marie, I'm sure you've seen a film called The Hunger from 1983, you know, a vampire film. Well, you know, if you're going to have a vampire come after you, let it be someone like Catherine Deneuve is sort of my take. But, you know, in terms of where film history is at that point, because her French films have made her such an iconic figure, she gets offers to appear in what I call like sort of straightforward, you know, Hollywood films. And I don't think The Hunger is a particularly great film, but she looks great in it. And you know, the casting is making full use of that physical presence we've talked about so often here.
One thing I wanted to see if you had the same idea with The Last Metro is I kind of think of it as the French Casablanca, because it's, you know, set in occupied Paris, and you have that whole sense of the war and all of that. Is that how you would categorize it?
Yeah, because when you think about what World War II meant for people living in Europe at that time, I mean, not that Americans sailed through it without incident or injury. I don't want to minimize that whatsoever. But, you know, to be in a country like France and to have been occupied by the Germans in World War II, I mean, the directness of that and how for, you know, a director like Truffaut, for some of the actors, cast and crew, people who actually lived through that, who knew it, right, from their own experience or certainly from their parents, how often that would serve as subject matter for subsequent films and how powerful and how lasting that influence was of what it meant in terms of the German occupation of France and so on. And so, yes, it, in some ways it is sort of a French variant on Casablanca. You're absolutely right. It's a really good observation there. And within Truffaut's career and within the careers of those actors, it's material that they take to readily. And that ready acceptance of it certainly translated to a really good box office in France and elsewhere. It's just that's what I was alluding to before. When you think about this film from 1980, in terms of the cast and crew and so on, they've really tapped into a subject that has really lasting appeal. And it's not just a matter of how I like that. It's more a matter of that was an important period in French history, and it affected all of us and still does. the living memory of that was still quite strong in the 70s into the 80s. And so when you see a piece like that, we tend to watch it now saying, well, Last Metro, it's a period movie, period piece, right? They're putting on the costumes and making believe they're an occupied. Well, yes and no. I mean, these are people who actually would have known this, right? There's a kind of lived experience that I think you get in a film like that. It doesn't just seem like a costume drama, does it?
No, it doesn't. It feels very much like you're watching something like Casablanca. It's just a really well-made film about a slice of time. So I do want to mention the big movie that I think Catherine Deneuve is known for. It was Indochine from 1992, which won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film, which is a really beautifully shot movie about where Catherine Deneuve plays a woman who adopts a Vietnamese child whose parents were her friends. And then things become complicated. There's an uprising in Vietnam against French colonial power, and things kind of go from there. That's a very powerful movie. What do you think, Mike?
Well, it is. And she also received an Academy Award nomination for that. So again, this sense of very much a French actress, and yet she's done the occasional film that would get not just wide distribution in the United States, but would get Academy Awards and would get her a nomination and so on. And you know, she's had the occasional English language role. And Indochine, I think in her later career, and she's still working, but you know, if we go back, let's say over the last 20, 25 years, Indochine would certainly be on the short list, maybe at the top of that short list in terms of, you know, the quality work she's done. She's made a lot of films in recent years where the films don't always hit or register in a lasting way, but her presence always does. But Indochine is a film that's firing on all cylinders, as I like to put it. It's really good subject matter. She's in great shape as an actor there, and you know, that iconic presence. So Marie, I'm just agreeing with you that, you know, Indochine, I think, would be, again, as I say, on that very short list of, if you watch a film of hers from these more recent decades, the one to go for.
Yeah, definitely watch that one, because she is, like you said, she's fantastic in it. And I think this is where she starts to, instead of playing the ingenue, starts to, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, you know, her career at a certain age where she is now middle-aged. But she doesn't fight it. She just kind of embraces it and is, you know, so she plays characters after this who are somebody's mother, or she plays the older character that's not supposed to be a younger character. It's supposed to be a person who is that age. And this is where I really think she's very enjoyable. And I think this is where people may be picking up Catherine Deneuve for the first time, not knowing how far back the back catalog goes. And so she's made some films that I would not call these great films, but certainly fun films. And I certainly like the idea that, you know, as an actor goes further in their career, that they could then take on projects that are just fun. And I'm thinking of 2005's Palais Royal, which is a comedy set in the world of European royalty. It's directed by Valerie Lemercier, who also is in it. And I caught it on TV Cinq Monde one day and laughed. You know, it's fluff, but it's very amusing. And she's great in it. And you kind of react to her differently than you would as the characters that she played in, like Umbrellas or The Last Metro or any of those iconic roles.
Let me add to that roster of more recent film credits, A Christmas Tale from 2008. Not a great film, but a greatly enjoyable film. And to your point, Marie, she plays the family matriarch here. And so she, you know, she is of a certain age now. And one of the blessings of the French industry is that older actresses still get work and still get great roles. That's not always the case in Hollywood. We could spend a full episode just talking about that. Sometimes Hollywood actresses of a certain age have sort of like the sell-by date stamped on them, and you know, audiences ostensibly don't want to see them at that point, or at least producers say that. In France, you can be an actress of a certain age and get great roles and look great and be age appropriate in many ways too. You can be the mother or grandmother, if you will. And that's your point, Marie, is that she looks really great in these roles and she really is comfortable with them. A quick footnote in terms of A Christmas Tale, this 2.5 hour long sprawling family melodrama. It's really enjoyable, as I say. I wouldn't say a great film, and she's great as the matriarch there. But in the casting of it, Chiara Mastroianni, who's the daughter she had by Marcello Mastroianni. She had one child by Roger Vadim. She had another child, Chiara, by Marcello Mastroianni, who is herself now a professional actress. In A Christmas Tale, Chiara Mastroianni plays the daughter-in-law of the matriarch I've been describing. So it's great inside baseball casting here, where, you know, her real-life daughter gets to play her daughter-in-law here. But Marie, what's your feeling about that film? Because I think it really totally encapsulates everything you've just been saying about late career films, whether Indochine or another film like Eight Women we could mention, 2002, where she's really such an iconic presence and she still holds the screen as much as ever.
I would also add Potiche to that list. It's the same kind of role. But again, if you feel like you're, you know, it's like an old friend rather than a quote unquote movie star, the unapproachable with reserve, but she still has that dignity. She also was the muse for Yves Saint Laurent, and he dressed her for Belle de Jour, Heartbeat, Mississippi Mermaid, A Cop, and The Hunger. So if you pick those two to watch from her long list of films, make sure you check out the clothes. So we just have a couple of minutes left, Mike, for any last thoughts you might want to put in for Eight Women or any other information about Catherine Deneuve.
Well, since you're mentioning the fashion plate image of Yves Saint Laurent and so on, also all the ads she did for Chanel, you know, this is a sign, and it's easy to joke about this, but all joking aside, of, you know, she represents France in so many ways, the face of France, Marianne, the image of France, but again, by way of fashion, and that certainly means a lot to the French, you know, how she's dressed, the image she presents, whether it's fashion or perfume or whatever, the fact that when you think about France culturally, she's on that short list of attributes. How many actors have that kind of presence? Where when you're talking about French culture in recent decades, she makes the list as much as any politician or anything else. That's really saying something. And what's also really saying something is the fact that she's still working. I mean, again, the fact that as an older actress in France, it's not an obstacle the way it traditionally had been or still is perhaps arguably in Hollywood. She gets great roles now. She works as much as she wants to. She can do what she wants. And you're right, Marie, in these more recent roles, she seems more relaxed. She seems more emotionally open, more comfortable, if you will. And that's an interesting point maybe for us to end on, is the fact that even though she had that cool, placid image, it has kind of warmed up a bit in more recent decades. What are your thoughts about that?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think you're also right about how she's lucky to be a French actress, where you actually could have a career that developed instead of sort of fell by the wayside. She has said that she thinks the best decade of her life was between 40 and 50. 40, she says, was the turning point for me as an actress. I mean, not every actress will be able to say that. She also said, I've had one motto, which I've always lived by, dignity, always dignity. And that wraps up our show about Catherine Deneuve. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.